Well, this worked well last time. Let's try it again. Hello, friends. And you are my friends. And welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast, the only podcast on Turner Time. I am the great Brian Last. And with me, as always, esteemed wrestling journalist David Bixenspan. Bix, how are you today?
I'm not doing too bad. How are you?
Not too bad. And also with us today, we have our returning champion, my new anger management therapist, Mr. Jim Cornette.
Well, now I'm returning the favor because you did so well for me. I'm even more hated than ever before after 2 weeks of you appearing. And by the way, hello, Bix, the human Xanax himself. And hello, friends. And you are indeed all my friends out there, except for the people who don't like me, in which case you can go fuck yourself.
I tried to figure out if the human Xanax is a compliment after recently we were talking to someone off air about
Scott
Mongolian
Teal.
Stomper. Yes.
We could say who it was. Scott Teal told us a story.
Well, it was off air. Yes.
Yeah.
And
He said that Don Fargo, he was upset that he hadn't gotten in touch with us before we recorded the Mongolian Stomper tribute episode because he thought it was important that we get out there that Don Fargo said that sitting next to the Mongolian Stomper was like sitting next to the human Quaalude.
Well, Archie was a very calm, soft-spoken, mild-mannered guy outside the ring and away from the spotlight. So that wasn't a knock. He was a very quiet man. Then one day he just went off, murdered the whole family with an axe. No, I kid. I joke.
Well, before we get too deep,
it's the quiet. Like Carlin said, it's the quiet ones you got to watch out for.
That's right.
Because normally people will say the quiet ones are the ones you got to watch out for. But in this case, if you're sitting in a bar calmly sipping a beer, and there's a guy over in the corner being quiet, minding his own business, reading a book, not saying a word to anybody, and there's another guy that comes in the front door swinging a fucking axe saying, "I'm going to kill every motherfucker in the place." Which one are you going to watch?
Just let everyone sit there. Before we go too deep into the show, Jim, I do want to talk about, just like we did last time, there's really some great stuff at jimcornette.com. Of course, Jim is the host of the Jim Cornette Experience every week, every Thursday on mlwradio.com and iTunes.
Well, it plays all week now. It plays all week. If it's not Thursday, you can still hear it, but it's just the new ones start on Thursday, and then they go all week long.
It drops on Thursday. You can get it whenever you want. It's on.
Well, I don't drop it. No, I handle it very carefully. I'm afraid it might break.
And Jim is also the proprietor of Cornette Collectibles, which is at jimcornette.com. And there's a lot of great stuff there. We've talked in the past about Jim's book, Tuesday Night at the Gardens, his fantastic history of Louisville wrestling book. But something I did want to talk about.
There's no Lucha merchandise there, though, unfortunately. I'm going to have to go out and get some of that. I'm going to start making my own Cornette face masks.
You know what? That actually probably be a big seller, I think.
Actually, if I'd had my Cornette face mask out, 30 years ago or so, they would have used that instead of the William Shatner mask in Halloween, and my face would have even been more famous.
I always forget that it's William Shatner as Michael Myers is wearing a William Shatner mask. I always forget who it is. I'm like, who was that again? Which mask was it?
Was that mask man?
Yeah, it's always the quiet ones,
The quiet ones you got to watch. All right, what are we doing here today on the program, the Super Podcast?
But I did want to plug here for you because I recently started watching it again and really enjoying it. But you have Jim Cornette, the Rookie Year DVD series. That's two volumes, I guess, four DVDs altogether. But just tell our listeners a little bit about it and how they can get it.
Well, you can get it, of course, at jimcornette.com. You can get almost anything at jimcornette.com. Some things require penicillin to cure, but you can get almost anything. And it's as you mentioned, a two-volume DVD set, two discs each, a total of 10 hours of my entire rookie year in professional wrestling, from my first appearance right on up to the last appearance I made on Memphis television before I went to Mid-South Wrestling and started managing the Midnight Express. And it comes with souvenir collector's booklets with all the contents and descriptions and pictures. It's illustrated, and backstage happenings and out of the ring occurrences that happened to me. It's you can read, you can watch, you can listen. It's multimedia for my entire rookie year. It encapsulates that, and you can get that at jimcornette.com. It's amazing.
I will certainly verify.
And it's also
that.
Some of the best quality Memphis wrestling television.
That's
out
right
there, because I was the only one smart enough to tape these things and save them. So it's first generation stuff, not like the shit you see on YouTube.
Well, we are going to talk about tape trading in a little while. That's one of the topics Bix and I want to get to. But I did want to start the show with something. We're approaching now 21 years since the passing of Eddie Gilbert. You, of course, were the last person he worked for in North America. Well, I shouldn't say North America, in the United States of America.
Well, in the continental United States.
The continental United States.
Eddie and Puerto Rico.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, you knew Eddie from when you were a kid and from when he was a kid, both of you shooting ringside, of course, him being the son of a wrestler and you just being a huge wrestling fan. What are your memories of, you know, the early days when you first met Eddie, and what was he like at those shows as just a teenage wrestling fan?
Well, actually, Eddie was, I think, pretty much exactly 1 month older than me. So we were both pretty much the same age. And Eddie kind of did the same thing on the other end of the territory as I was doing up in the northern end in Louisville, is that he went to the matches, obviously, with his father, Tommy, from the time he was young. And he got a camera, started taking pictures and sending articles into to the wrestling magazines. And so he was kind of shooting from the Memphis end, and I was up in the Louisville end. And when he got older, I think the first time I met him, probably we were 16 or so, he was able to get out of school in the summertime and come make some trips with Tommy. And we were at the WFIA, the Wrestling Fans International Association conventions in Knoxville in 78 and Memphis in 79. And that was right before he started wrestling as a pro when he turned 18. And, you know, Eddie, he was a great kid. You know, he was, once again, really well-mannered, polite, and loved wrestling. And was obviously his father's biggest fan in the world. Tommy was a great talent here in the Tennessee territory for years, a great wrestler, unheralded in a lot of parts of the country because, you know, he traveled, he made appearances in West Texas for the Funks quite a bit because he reminded me of Dory in the ring. The Gilberts always idolized the Funk family, and Tommy wrestled a lot like, especially in his younger days, a lot like Dory. And Tommy had some good runs in Florida, but primarily he wrestled in the Tennessee territories. And, you know, he was a great talent, at whether it be a tag team wrestler or a single. So Eddie was his biggest fan, followed in his footsteps. And Eddie's first spot really in Memphis was in the father-son tag team with Tommy. So, yeah, we had known each other for a long time. And that's why I was, you know, particularly sad that we didn't get to work together longer in Smoky Mountain. It was a time where Eddie was on the outs with the Memphis territory, which he got on occasion, and he was home in Lexington, Tennessee, and I heard that he was just, you know, he was sitting at home, and I said, my God, he's too good. He's on the other side of the state, not to use him. And I called him and asked if he would come in and be partners with this big kid that Dutch Mantel had recommended from Puerto Rico, who wanted to get out of Puerto Rico. His name was Glenn Jacobs. We called him Unabomb back then, but he later became Kane. And I wanted Eddie as the smaller, you know, loudmouth, great promo and great worker to lead this big, huge, you know, giant rookie and be a team. And he came in and made the first TVs, and then he got a chance to go and take the book in Puerto Rico. And so that's how Al Snow eventually came in and became played the part of Eddie Gilbert as partners to Unabomb.
Now, obviously, you had this relationship with Eddie because you had known each other since you were kids. And, you know, in many ways, you guys were similar in that you started out as huge fans. And, you know, you both became bookers at a young age and had a lot of opportunities from the creative end. You know, Eddie had a little bit of a reputation after he left WCW. Well, maybe even before then, but specifically after he left, as being a wild card, someone who would pull his own angles or walk out or do all sorts of things. Did you... When you approach him about coming into Smoky Mountain, I know you and him were both at the NWA tournament in November of that year, November of 94, shortly before that, because I was there for Dennis Carluzzo. But when you know, here's your friend you've known for years, do you have to have a conversation with him and just say, look, Eddie, I know you've done a lot of these things, you know, don't do it here. I'll kill you. How do you approach that?
Actually, I took a more positive tone to it because, you know, I could understand a lot of times, and believe me, and as time has gone on, I understand when you're a booker and you care about your product, you get cranky with people when they start fucking with it.
Right.
This was well after he had parted ways with Happy Heyman, you know, when Paulie kind of jacked him out of the ECW thing. You know, so I just told him, I said, Eddie, I said, I don't care who gets the credit for this as long as we draw some money. So I really want you to take a hands-on, you know, approach, hands-on, you know, with your own angle and whatever we do here, please feel free, pitch ideas, come up with shit. you know, we will do it. I'm not going to be stingy about that. I want you to feel good about what you're doing. So we had that understanding, and really he made one TV. So we didn't, it didn't go far enough that, that it became, you know, an issue. Of course, then to be quite honest, the way I found out that he took the book and Puerto Rico was when I found out he was booking in Puerto Rico. He never actually called me and told me he was never coming back. But you know, I that's the one thing I wish he'd have stayed in Knoxville, because you can't get into nearly as many things in Knoxville as you can in Puerto Rico, and as things may have been different.
Something yeah. I've always wondered about, I guess it's not really a run because it's the one taping he had with you in Smoky Mountain, is that his promos, especially the first promo he cuts when he comes in, it seems like he's kind of playing off the rep he had at the time, because he's acting very like fidgety and paranoid, but it's clearly a put on. So, like, was that your idea? Was that his idea? Like, where did all that come from?
No, whatever he did was his thing. I told him, I gave him the premise. Here, you're coming in with this huge, you know, masked guy as a partner. Do your thing. Cut promos. We're coming up on a big event in Knoxville where, you know, a month from now where you're going to make your debut. And the rest of it was whatever Eddie wanted to do. And I will say one. I think that Eddie had been in Philadelphia for so long that he tended to do a little bit more for Smart fans than what was necessary in Knoxville, because there weren't that many, and we certainly weren't playing to them. And you know, maybe that was just because the last high profile spot he'd had has been in Philly, where you know everybody was Smart then. But you know, otherwise than that, no, I didn't tell him to do anything otherwise than go out and cut promos and have a couple good matches.
I mean, it is kind of interesting because it shows that he was very self-aware of how people were seeing him at the time.
Oh, yeah. I think he knew. Yeah. Well, I would imagine he read everything that was written about him and kept up. And so, yeah, he definitely knew what was, you know, what people were thinking or saying or whatever. And that's why I thought he would really work especially hard, because he would have a point to prove, you know, that he could still get things done, even if people thought, like, sometimes people think I'm insane, and I probably am, but, you know, not in the way that they think, you know, so I thought he would, you know, really dig in and show, you know, hey, you stupid assholes, I can do this shit. And he probably would have if he'd have stuck around.
Did he ever talk to you about, like, going on the internet to get feedback and stuff like that? Because that was something I had no idea he did until I was researching the article I did about him for Fighting Spirit last year, that first it was Terry Sims who told me, and then Terry also pointed me to the interview he did with Joe Pedicino on his podcast, saying that, yeah, that like very early internet, when Eddie was booking Global, he would go online under a pseudonym to try to get feedback about the Global shows and then use that in his booking.
I didn't know that. To be honest, if you till the day I closed Smoky Mountain Wrestling down, if you'd have said the word internet to me, I would have gone, what the fuck are you talking about? I'd never seen a computer at that point in time. The first computer I think that I ever saw was when my girlfriend slash wife at the time got one when we were in Connecticut, I believe, because I, you know, but I didn't know. I knew Eddie would read the sheets. Everybody read, you know, some of the sheets that wanted to stay in touch with, you know, who was wrestling where and what was going on. But I didn't know he went to that length.
Had you been a member?
But yeah, no, I had never seen of, heard or of, give a shit about the internet. When I first encountered it, it was that deal where you had to get online and or get on the phone and dial it up and everything. I thought, who is ever going to do this shit? This is fuck. It was always too much trouble. It's still too much trouble for me. If I, you know, unfortunately didn't have to use it to communicate with other people and do shit that you got to do, I wouldn't have a computer in my fucking house. I'd have more books. I'd have room for more books and things to read where you really learn things.
You know, Bix, you'll probably appreciate this, but, when growing up, you know, myself as Bix did, listen to John Arezzi's Pro Wrestling Spotlight show, and Don Leibel did the wrestling updates. And, you know, before, you know,
I've known Donnie since before either one of you were born.
That's right. And, you know, you never knew where Don got his news. And I remember the exact week when I figured out he gets the Observer and he reads the news from the Observer. It's because when Eddie debuted in Smoky Mountain Wrestling with his tag team partner, Unabomb, you know, Don hadn't seen any of that footage and hadn't spoken to anyone. He was just going based on the Observer. So he announced on the air, he goes, you know, Eddie Gilbert's now in Smoky Mountain Wrestling with a new tag team partner, Unabomb. I said, oh. He's reading it out of the newsletter.
Hey, do you know, by the way, just a side note, do you know who was the first person to ever show me a Wrestling Observer?
The first person. Give me the year, and I'll guess the person.
1985.
85. Okay, so you're already 85. You ain't going to guess the
person. You ain't going to guess.
So wait, did you not trade tapes with Dave then?
No.
Okay.
I had not met or become aware of Dave, and it was late 85. It was fall 85.
Okay, so because at first I was going to say Bill Watts, but you weren't working for him then.
You're in Crockett by that point. Late 85, you're with Crockett. We wouldn't guess who it is. I don't think you were that close with Dusty, so I don't think it was Dusty.
It was the first person that at least would admit this in public in the locker room that had ever seen it before.
Is this someone we would perceive as stupid?
It's something you would perceive as odd. I'll go ahead and tell you because we're on a podcast and they can't see us rubbing our brows and thinking. Yeah.
Jimmy Valiant?
Gorgeous Jimmy Garvin.
Wow, really? Huh.
Because somewhere or another he got one. I don't know from where. I don't know if he subscribed. I don't know if somebody handed him one. But he was saying, hey, look at this. He called it the scandal sheet. It wasn't a dirt sheet. It was the scandal sheet. And he was showing it around when we were doing promos every Wednesday at Crockett's office. We would get there at 9 o'clock in the morning, leave about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we would eat chicken and do promos. And he was passing around, and all the guys would take a look at it and go, oh, fuck this. Hopefully this doesn't go anywhere, you know, because it was exposing the business, and that was a concern. But when I read, because I read anything to do with wrestling, and I read a little bit of it, and I said, well, you know, the thing is, this guy actually knows what the fuck he's talking about. and I had to see more, and then I wrote and subscribed and bought the back issues. And
are got your name?
Even, well, yeah.
Okay.
What the fuck? Like, I'm a, you know, hi, my name's, you know, fucking.
Well, you always hear that Howard Finkel subscribed under his wife's name.
Well, Fink, I guess, you know, he was doing, because he would do the Finkel report every morning for Vince. He would get to the office at like 5 a.m. and he would either transcribe the hotlines or he'd read the sheets, or then later on when the internet came about, and he would put anything that he thought that Vince and his office should know in the Finkel report. Sometimes it was a page, sometimes it was 10 pages.
I have one of those from the Ultimate Warrior lawsuit.
There you go. I've got a bunch of them that I, except some of that fax paper, the slick fax paper you used to use back in the 90s, sometimes the ink just completely fades off that thing.
Yeah.
But originally, yes, that's where I first saw the Observer, and I was struck immediately by the fact that, you know, it wouldn't be good for the business if the regular people saw this, but shit, the guy actually knows what he's talking about, and if he gave a review of something, more often than not, it reflected the way I thought about something. So, you know, that's where I started with that. But the scandal sheet.
You know, you mentioned Jimmy Garvin. And Jimmy Garvin's a guy I find really entertaining from his Dallas run up until when he turned babyface.
Until he became a free bird.
Well, then he becomes a free bird, and then he becomes unwatchable. What happened? Is it as simple as him teaming with Michael Hayes, or
he probably, yeah, because Hayes filled his fucking head full that they were going to be as big as him and Gordy and Buddy were, and it just wasn't going to fucking happen. But no, I love Jimmy Garvin. Even back in the days when he was a manager of Ron and Terry, I saw him in the early 70s when he was 18 years old and skinny and bleach blonde. I liked him as a wrestler. I thought he had a good gimmick. Liked him and Precious. We were friends, actually. A lot of times me and Bobby and Dennis, or Bobby and Stan, would rent cars with him and Precious, because they were the only ones as cheap as we were. When the horsemen were out there renting the Lincoln Town cars or getting limousines, we were getting the smallest compact car that we could for the day in Atlanta to go to TV from the airport and back, and you know, pizza in the room or whatever. And, you know, there were, as a matter of fact, my wife at the time, back in the 80s, and their nanny, their kid's nanny, were friends, and we were over at the house a few times. But suddenly, you know, when Jimmy got that fucking spot with Michael Hayes and became a free bird, he got on the supplements because he was 5'9 and 205, and instead of being a chicken shit heel that had worked for him all his life, started trying to be this badass, and they didn't want to sell, and they didn't want to put anybody over, and they did, you know, and blah, 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 and he became just unbearable to be around, and I had a number of fucking issues with him, and have never thought the same of him to this day, because I didn't see why it had to be that way.
And
but I've never been on those kinds of supplements, so I imagine if I was on those kind of supplements with my issues already. Right?
That would not be. That wouldn't be pretty.
That wouldn't be fucking good.
And then, for those who haven't read the Midnight Express scrapbook, which I guess you can't get at JimCornette.com anymore.
Well, it is out of print, but it did have the story of when they actually
tried. That's what I was getting to. Yeah,
yeah, they tried to bow up and big dog Dr. Death Steve Williams in Boston. Would you like me to tell the story or just leave it there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it was a 6-man tag. It was Michael and Jimmy and Terry Gordy against Bobby Eaton, Stan Lane, and Dr. Death Steve Williams. And we were the baby faces. I was in the corner. And of course, it was Death as it was. But we had turned baby face against the original Midnight and Paul Lee. So I had somebody in the corner opposite me. But we're wrestling the Freebirds. It was 4 baby faces, in effect, against 3 heels. And they didn't want to sell, and we were already doing a job for them because, you know, Herd was around, and we couldn't win a match with Herd around. And they were trying fruitlessly to get these fucking guys over. And Terry was just in and out on his way back and forth to Japan, so it was really Michael and Jimmy. But anyway, in the Boston Garden one night, we have a little match with him. They do a few spots, then they get a long set of heat, I believe, on Stan. Then Bobby tags in, makes a comeback, and then they beat him. And then while we're selling afterwards, they wanted to jump on him and start beating him up some more. And Doc got a little fucking fed up and started trying to make a fucking comeback. And they weren't even going to sell for Dr. Death. So he took one of those old wooden chairs that they had in the Boston Garden, which was a complete shithole, by the way. I mean, holes in the wall big enough to throw a cat through in the locker room. And he took that chair. And when Jimmy Garvin wouldn't run for him, he drew it back over his head and he whacked Jimmy Garvin as hard as he could with that thing. And when he went whack and Jimmy Garvin screamed, fuck. And Doc said, fuck with me. And he hit him again, whack. And Garvin said, fuck. And Doc said, fuck with me. Whack. It just repeated that as Garvin had his arms up over his fucking head. I don't know whether it was pieces of Jimmy Garvin or the chair that were flying, but he chipped bones at his elbow. He fucking cut his fucking forearms up. He dinged his fucking head. And they ran back to the fucking locker room. And here goes Doc. And well, here goes Bobby and Stan. And I'm following the team, right? And I figured this is going to be interesting. We get back there, and as soon as we got back there, I don't think Gordy wanted to fight because he knew it was horseshit. He was the only one that would, the only one that shouldn't sell for us is the only one that was, right? Yeah. And he and Bobby had been friends for years, and so Gordy didn't want to fight. I'm sure Michael and Jimmy probably didn't want to either, but they were going to. And when the fucking Doc comes in and Bobby Eaton, of all people, just says, hey, you know what? We ain't just fucking here to get you fucking guys over. And Bobby, being mad about something for the first time ever in history, just snapped everybody out of it. And they all went and grumbled. And Garvin took a week off or a few days or how long he had to take off. And he didn't fuck with Dr. Death again. he yelled at me one time. This is one of the other problems we had. We're in the ring doing something. The Freebirds hit the ring, and Garvin comes over and charges toward me and nails me with a punch. So I go down, boom, and also he charged me so fucking hard. He didn't hurt me with the punch, but he clipped me body-wise and kind of my knee kind of went sideways. It's tweaked my knee. I go down. I roll out on the floor. I sell it. A bunch of other baby faces hit, clear them out. I get up. I put my arm around one of the baby faces. He helps me. I limp back to the locker room. There's Garvin fucking yelling at me. What the fuck? You know to sell for me? Well, you fucking prick. Number one, I'm bigger than you are. You're just on fucking steroids and you're a goddamn ass. But I said, what the fuck? I went down. I roll out of the ring. I fucking limp back. You hit me one time. Who the fuck are you? Joe Lewis? He's fucking screaming. I went to Eddie Gilbert, who was on the booking committee at the time. I said, what is his fucking problem? He said, you just don't worry about it. It was fine. Just fucking ignore him. You know, he went nuts. And they actually thought that fucking half brand fucking Freebird team was going to get over like the real ones, and it didn't, as we know, and you know, and then Jimmy became a pilot,
and then they had the pleasure of working with the Steiner brothers.
But oh yeah, then boy, then the Steiners loved to fuck with them too, because they were the shits. The Steiners, we had great matches with them, and Rick and Scott liked working with the Midnight, but they'd never book us with them because they were paying Garvin and Hayes more money, so they wanted to book them with the top teams, and fucking then so Rick would and Scott would take it out on them. But then finally, Herd, like 3 months after I had said, maybe 6 months after I'd said, tell you what, Jim, just pay us half what you owe us on our fucking contract, save the trance, and we'll all leave. Well, I don't want to set that precedent. Well, then he wanted to get rid of Jimmy Garvin so bad that he ended up doing that. He gave him half what he owed him on the fucking 2-year contract he had just signed, and he went home and became a pilot. That's when he quit the business. So everybody's happy.
I remember when I was 10 years old, I slept over at a friend's house, and he was – this is 1990 – and he was only a WWF fan. He never watched NWA. And I was watching both at a time. And I knew Friday night, late at night, you know, maybe 10 o'clock, I said, you know what? Wrestling's on. Let's watch this. And he said, okay, I've never seen these guys. And the first thing that happens to be on the show are the Freebirds of Hayes and Garvin.
Oh,
and
boy.
They come down to the ring, and they're doing a thing where they point at each other. And Michael Hayes is on the top rope pointing down at Jimmy, and Jimmy's thrusting and pointing at him. And I never forget my friend just exclaiming, he goes, they're gay.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, but, yeah. This is one of my lasting memories of that version of the Freebirds.
I don't think the Freebirds were ever supposed to come off as gay lovers. I really don't. It wasn't what originally got them over.
The one redeeming thing about the WCW Freebirds, when they would host the pro with Lance Russell, that was absolutely tremendous television.
I do remember that. I do remember that. That wasn't bad.
All right. Gentlemen, I want to move on to a new topic here. And for those listeners at home who'd like to contribute questions or thoughts or push us in certain directions, I would encourage you to visit us at facebook.com/superpodcast. It's our new Facebook page. We're trying to set up a fun little community so we could all have fun together. And this question is from a longtime friend of mine from Smoky Mountain Wrestling Fan Week and a friend of the show, Scott Cornish. And Scott has...
Scott! Hello, Scott!
Scott has asked this question.
Is he out yet? I heard he was up for parole.
It's any day now. Any day now. Everyone tells us that Haku was the baddest and toughest street fighter of them all. They also tell you that Haku is the sweetest, most good-natured guy in the world. And they have all witnessed him almost kill a man in a bar fight, or at least gouge his eye out.
Actually, he bit his nose off.
Question. Why on earth does every drunk in every bar always pick a fight with easygoing, peaceful Haku?
Well, and here's the thing. Haku's one of the island boys, and you don't fuck around, as Gary Hart would say. You don't fuck with the island boys, man. actually, the way that I heard it was that when in the nose biting in question, which I believe happened up in Baltimore, that Haku and a few of the other guys, guys had been in the bar at the hotel and it was closing and they were leaving and they encountered some guys sitting out in the lobby who said something about, well, that's those fake wrestlers, right? And he said, oh, yeah, I'll show you how fucking fake we are, which is what the boys used to do and take up for the fucking business. And he bit the guy's nose or tried to bite it off. Maybe it didn't go all the way off. Whatever the fuck. There was a lawsuit, et cetera, et cetera. But... you know, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. People somehow think that, you know, especially a guy that looks like that. I don't know what they're thinking about, but people somehow think that you can just go up and call wrestlers fake and they won't just – and now you can. And they won't even say – they'll probably laugh and agree with you. But back then when actually the business drew money and large crowds and people took it seriously – if you called a wrestler fake, that was the easiest way to get your fucking ass beat. And that as it rightfully should be. I've said that to a number of people that, you know, I said, I don't call your mother, just walk up to your face, call your mother a fucking douchebag whore. So why do you fucking call me a fucking fake? For some reason they thought because that they thought or believed that wrestling was predetermined, that meant that the wrestler in question couldn't whip cream with an outboard motor and wasn't going to just knock you stiffer in a goddamn board if you fucking insulted him and insulted his business. And they found out different. The best comeback to is wrestling fake or anything like that that I've ever heard wasn't even physical. It was, as you would figure, it was from Jerry Jarrett. Jerry Jarrett and Bill Dundee go into Wendy's one night in Memphis, and they're the last ones in there. It's about to close up. They've come back from a show, and of course, since it's Memphis, since they're on TV, everybody knows who they are. And the manager comes up, and he wasn't even being really a prick about it, but he just goes, hey, you know, that blood, you know, that blood's fake in that wrestling that y'all do, right? And Jerry Jarrett said, no, it's not. Why would you think that? Actually, what happens is we take a razor blade, and we cut it down, and we put tape around it, and we hold it in our mouth. And whenever it's time for us to bleed, we spit it out. We cut the shit out of our heads with it until we're bleeding, and then we put it back in our mouth, or maybe we stick it down in the crotch of our tights. And the guy said, all right, motherfucker, if you didn't want to tell me, you don't just say so. You don't have to be a smartass about it. So, you know.
With Haku, I believe there is a eye gouging incident. I think it happened in Baltimore. There, of course, is the Jesse Barr incident where he bit Jesse Barr's nose off. Let me ask you, Jim, who is there anyone you could think of who, you know, for the most part, you wouldn't think of as a troublemaker, yet couldn't escape out, you know, after the show, getting into a fight in a bar or somewhere else?
Well, I've heard in the old days, Dick the Bruiser used to be just, that was his recreation. After the matches, he'd go and try to get in a fucking fight. You know, I haven't known that many. I've known a lot of people. I mean, you know, Hawk wasn't going to back down from a lot of people. Hercules Hernandez, Dr. Death, Haku, you know, a lot of people that weren't going to back down from people. But I think I don't really remember a lot of guys that just were trying to go out and fuck with people, and, you know, because they're the lawsuit thing, you know.
Yeah,
we had enough trouble with that inside the building, much less outside. Plus, you never know what's going to happen. And that the reason a lot of people have also misunderstood when Bill Watts said, if you get in a bar fight and you lose, I'll fire you. That means to some idiots out there on the internet, and of course, as Bill Maher said last week, the internet has killed the truth. That Watts wanted the guys to go out and get in bar fights and beat people up. No, he said, I don't want you to go out and get in a fucking fight at all, because it's probably going to cost us all money. But if you do have to go out and get in a fucking fight, you better win or you're going to get sued and I'm going to fire you, because you just proved that you're goddamn, you know, weak as cat's piss. And I want tough wrestlers on my goddamn roster that people believe in. So he didn't want the guys to get in a fight, but if they got in a fight, he better win. Now, I was exempt from that. I think if I'd have won a fight, he'd have probably fired me because it had killed my gimmick. But I didn't go out in public in Louisiana for a year anyway. I knew better than that. I went to drive-thrus, self-service gas stations, rode with the boys, or stayed in the house.
What exactly was
the... I didn't go to the fucking mall.
What exactly was the story with when Bob Orton Jr. got fired by Watts? Because, like, Watts has kind of half-told the story. But it's something like Bob got in a fight and either, I forget exactly if he said, like, guys jumped him or whatever, and Bill said something like he fired him because there were no bruises on his knuckles, so whatever happened, he didn't try to fight back. But the whole thing I'm trying to figure out is because Bob Orton was a really tough guy.
Yeah, well, Brian, I almost have to defer to you on that one, because we were not in the territory at the time. Orton was there a couple of years before we got there, and I don't know if I know anything more than what Bix just said.
I remember at the 97 Eddie Gilbert Memorial Brawl when they did the Brunchen.
Right, that's where I heard it from the video.
Yeah, Bill Watts. It was one of the great Bill Watts speeches ever. Because, you know, it's a little, 10% religion and then, you know, all about Eddie and what a great guy is. And then it's just Watts just, you know, for no reason, just, you know, I fired Bob Orton because he got into a fight and lost. And Rick Rude's on steroids. And just, you know, it's like one thing after another.
It's like suddenly he gets Tourette's and just comes out with shit.
Yeah. And also, I loved him just randomly doing shtick with Buddy Landell.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, they sent all these guys from Tennessee. I brought all these guys from Tennessee into the territory. There was Cornette. He was great. Midnight Express, Rock and Rolls, Terry Taylor. There was this one other guy. I can't remember. And then Buddy's making faces. It was tremendous.
Well, actually, Buddy at one time was making installment payments on his fines. Because he had been fined so much for being late or for no showing or for doing something stupid in the match or for violating a dress code or whatever, that you couldn't just take all that money out of one check. There wasn't enough, so he was making payments on the fines. But sooner or later, he learned. that territory was where Buddy became a top guy. He had been, you know, he'd been working in a pretty good spot in Memphis in 83, but when he got to Louisiana in 84... he learned how to be a top guy, and then, you know, he was a main event guy for Crockett for a couple years, or, well, not even, until he couldn't get out of bed that day at Atlanta TV.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that we talked about last time you were on the show that was very popular is tape trading and just, you know, your history with tape trading, and we wanted to touch on this topic again, Jim. I'm curious, when exactly was the first time you saw certain territories, and what were your initial thoughts? Like, when was the first time you saw Dallas TV or Mid-South TV, and what did you think when you first saw them?
The first time I saw Mid-South TV was probably like 1980-ish, right after I got a VCR, because Randy Hales, who also was one of the early VCR guys, he lived in Jonesboro, Arkansas, because he was working, you know, as an announcer, and that was before he started booking in Memphis, but he did some announcing and et cetera. And the top northwest corner of the Watts territory abutted the lower southwest corner of the Memphis territory. And so Randy would send me some tapes, snowy, but some tapes of Mid-South TV, and it was just, you know, it was fantastic. The matches were great. You know, when you've got talent down there like that at that time, like Ernie Ladd and DiBiase and Orndorff's early days, his first, you know, real top spot after he'd – well, I won't say first real top spot. He'd been in Crockett and teamed with Snuka, and he'd been here, et cetera. But anyway, you know, great talent, believable. You know, I thought it was great. The Dallas TV – when I first saw it was those dark days, right as Fritz was retiring and the boys were wrestling, but it was still the, you know, the Armand Hussein type, you know, heels.
Yeah. And, early 82, maybe.
Yeah. You know, in between 80 and 82, before the Freebirds came in, where it, Dallas had become a shell of its former self, as far as it didn't supply talent to the entire state of Texas. Paul Bosch had split off and gone with the AWA champion, and then Houston, or then Mid-South, and Joe Blanchard had started Southwest and gone on his own. And of course, the Funks territory wasn't the Funks anymore, but Amarillo was still on its own. So Dallas had been a bigger money territory when Fritz was still on top and in his prime, but had kind of sunk, and the boys hadn't caught on yet because they had nobody to fight. So the Dallas TV was a little bland, little dry.
Where did you get it?
I remember this one guy in Detroit that actually he had connections, because he even had VCRs before I did. And I would get a compilation tape, and there would be some chic stuff from Detroit, late 70s. There'd be even Memphis stuff that I had not gotten, that I'd seen, but I didn't have a VCR yet. And Atlanta stuff, the, you know, DiBiase taking the five pile drivers on the floor. He would have these compilation tapes, and it was on some of those. And then, of course, very early, I also saw the Japanese tapes and got a hookup for those. So it was different people mailing each other, you know, different tapes from all over the country.
Well, you know, it's something that Bix and I had talked about on the show before, something that happened to me when I first started tape trading. Were you ever burned where you sent someone a tape and they didn't send you something back, or they didn't send you what you agreed to, or, you know, the quality wasn't represented?
I wasn't worried about quality at that point, because it was better than what we'd had before, which was nothing. I mean, when you think about it, I'm getting a tape of wrestling from outside my area 3 months after the very first time that I ever had a VCR in my home. It was like, my God, this is incredible. I can actually tape TV programs in my house. That's unheard of. Who the fuck have ever thought we could do that, right? So people today don't understand what the fuck that was like. So I don't care what quality it was. You know, the same guy from Detroit sent me a copy of Raiders of the Lost Ark when it was barely out of theaters, but it actually had been taped by a guy in a camera in the back row. You know, you can imagine what that looked like. but what the fuck quality? As far as I'm sure I probably burned people too, just not meaning to, just by, oh shit, you sent me two, I only sent you one, or I forgot to send it. Because, you know, it was a loose thing. It wasn't really, you know, that orchestrated yet.
Yeah.
You were just glad to get anything, right? You know, once again, when I first got cable, I was like, shit, there's 35 fucking stations on this thing now. Because I'd only had four before. So what, you know, it wasn't like you were picking at nits in those days.
When was the first time you saw, I guess I'll call it Southeastern, you know, whatever, or part of the territory that eventually became continental. Anything like, for whether it's from Knoxville or Alabama or whatever.
Oh, well, now that was in the mid-70s, because my uncle Harold lived in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Uh-huh. And when we would go down for family vacations, you know, the first thing I would do. And it was great because now think about this. Little bitty Oak Ridge, Tennessee in the mid-70s had cable. And wow. The reason – well, I've been told the reason why that they had cable in some of the outlying areas in East Tennessee at that point was because it was almost impossible for some of those people in the hills to pick up more than one or two TV stations.
Right.
And still, in the mid-90s, there was a cable system, if you can call it that, in western Virginia, up around Hayside, Virginia, in that area. Those people will know what I'm talking about. And – that cable system served those people because they could only get one TV station if they had an antenna, Channel 5 out of Bristol. Everything else, it was too remote and isolated. So they had a local cable system that had about 12 or 14 channels they'd bring in, and that's what you could watch. But depending on what was on and the whims of the guy that ran the cable system, Channel 8 might be one station one week, and it might be another station the other week, depending on if there was something better on. So, and this was 20 years ago. But I got to watch Knoxville Wrestling on Channel 10, WBIR, Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock for Southeastern Championship Wrestling with Les Thatcher and Phil Rainey. I also got to see Crockett Show Worldwide Wrestling from Channel 13 in Asheville, North Carolina, Saturday night at 11:30 after the news. And I also got to see Chattanooga, the Gulas tape, with Harry Thornton hosting off of Channel 3, I believe it was, WRCB, in Chattanooga. So and Channel 17, Atlanta, the first time I saw Dusty Rhodes, the first time I saw the TBS show on Saturday nights. It was so I loved to go to Uncle Harold's, but they always wanted to go fishing. And I was like, no, give me a sack of potato chips and leave me alone for Saturday. I'm going to watch 7 hours of fucking wrestling. And I would sit there in front of the TV and never leave while they were out fishing. And it was much better than going to my Aunt Lola's across the river from Cincinnati, because all I could get there was the Sheik's TV, which I like to watch on occasion. But 1 hour of Sheik's TV from Detroit versus 7 hours of Southeastern and all that other stuff was there. No, there's no way.
Yeah.
When you first saw Mid-South, was that when Terry Orndorff was around, or was this
yes.
after?
Yeah, no, Terry Orndorff was down there then at that point, and the Angel, Frank Morrell, who I would later come to know well from Tennessee, and he managed some, had just finished his big run with Rock Hunter and the Assassin and those guys, and they had just started going to the Superdome in those days, and so it was really cool.
What was Terry Orndorff like? Because, like, that era is not really floating around, and it's... like, he's a guy who, it's like, he's kind of weird because he was sort of a star and he was Paul's brother, but people don't really talk about him. I don't think I've ever seen him. Brian, have you ever seen him wrestle?
I've seen a clip here and there, maybe some 81 Mid-South, but very, very little of him. He's in a bunch of the programs I have from that time, but, you know, there's very little I know about him, and I certainly haven't seen that much of him.
You know, actually, nobody has mentioned his name to me in probably 30 fucking years. I remember seeing him. You know, there wasn't anybody on Mid-South TV at that point that wasn't really a pretty good worker. So it wasn't like he stood out as being, you know, like George Gulas or whatever. I don't think that he and Paul were really brothers, were they? I don't know who he was or where he went afterwards.
I thought he was really his brother.
Well, maybe. I've never asked Paul about it. Never thought to. I don't know. Now, that, as a matter of fact, let's put it out for the fans who of the 605 Super Podcast and also the Jim Cornette Experience. Fill us in on Terry Orndorff.
You know, I got a weird question for you, Jim. It was something I talked about with Bix here on the show before, just about my enjoyment with Memphis, watching old Memphis tapes, and how the look of the studio, sometimes it takes away. If it doesn't look cool enough to me, it's not as good as the stuff that does look cool. What was your favorite look of the Memphis studio? When it had the black background or the blue background, or what did you think was the best look?
I liked the blue, because the black... and also selfishly for my videotapes, it showed the ghost, because this was before cable. We didn't have cable in Louisville here where I live until after I'd already moved away and gotten a business. So I had that big antenna up on my roof, but I believe we've talked about this. Daggum, they built that bank building in downtown Louisville and it put a ghost in Channel 3 for the people out here in the eastern part of the county. So, but the blue, it wasn't even blue. It was a flat, like a beige a background that they would then hit with colored lights, and whatever those colored spots and gels that they that they put at the foot of the background would color the back wall with, you know, however they wanted it to be colored. And it was cool, and they could switch it around a lot. But I like that because it just kind of it brightened things up a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I remember back at Channel 13, before they moved into Channel 5 in 1977, Channel 13 studio, you could see like a concrete block wall, and then there was a curtain, and then there was a cardboard box sitting there, and, you know, it was not a pretty studio.
Well, nothing is cheaper than ICW TV from, you know, around that period.
Oh, my God. That was over at – it used to be Channel 62 in those days. Now it's Channel 36, but it was the weak sister of the three TV stations in Lexington, and they had one row on two sides of the ring of fans because they shot like a weekday at like 10 in the morning. And in the early days, they actually had a background with people painted on it that they would put behind that one row.
Oh, like in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, they did it. Yeah, they did it up there too. And then they got away from that, and they just had one row on two sides of the ring of people.
Honestly, I would say from the little we've seen, the Knoxville All-Star Outlaw TV that sort of was either concurrent with and then morphed into ICW or however it happened. I think that looks cheaper because it looks like it's in someone's living room.
It almost was, and it was right before ICW because that's the time where Ron Wright and had broken off because he wasn't being quote unquote paid like a partner, and Orton and Roop and Malenko and Garvin had broken off and formed All Star Wrestling with him away from Southeastern. But meanwhile, the Poffos and their group were running ICW out in Paducah and Cape Girardeau, and they kind of met in the middle in the Lexington area and pooled their resources. That's the one that people now these days go, oh, that TV studio, Bush. In its day, Channel 5's Memphis studio show was exciting. There was a ton of people in there. It was always packed. As a matter of fact, there was a waiting list. You had to have a ticket to go in. The tickets were free because Channel 5 wasn't in the business of you know, selling tickets to charge admission, but you had to have a ticket to come in their studio. So there was a waiting list at one time of up to 6 months to get a ticket to get into that studio where they would hold maybe, what was it, 100, 125 people at that point. But what a great atmosphere it was. And they were so loud and in such a small space, you could barely hear yourself think.
You know, other than Poffo's ICW, do you recall any other outlaw groups that ran against Jarrett during that time?
Actually, there was nobody of any note, and nobody really with Nick tried to come up to Louisville in 1978, and succeeded. The only wrestling program I know of in the last 50 years to get on Channel 11, which was kind of the Rudy Tooty Snooty station. But otherwise than that, really, no, there were a few outlaws. There was a group over in Georgetown, Kentucky, outside of Lexington that would run at this little barn. And there were a few. Bobby Fulton, that was one of the first places he ever worked when he got into business as a teenager. But there was really no opposition, appreciable opposition to speak of. And they, I mean, even when Nick couldn't take his own, you know, former territory back, and when, you know, the Poffos, even with Randy Savage and Bob Orton Jr. and Ronnie Garvin and recognized stars, when they couldn't make a go of it, nobody else was going to fight Jarrett. It just, they were the established incumbent, and they weren't going to get rattled out.
Now, I know it technically wasn't an outlaw promotion, really, because it's not like they were opposition or anything, but Last year, when I was doing that Eddie Gilbert article, because it's where he started, I talked to you a little bit about the Malden, Missouri promotion that Henry Rogers had. And recently, going like through some old newsletters, I found out they had TV at least sometime. Like, did you ever see that?
Well, no, and most people didn't see. Here's the thing. Malden, there was a guy named Henry Rogers who was a promoter in Malden, Missouri, which was in the Memphis market. Because Memphis, of course, sits right on the bluff at the river there. So they're across the river from Arkansas. They're not far from Missouri. They're right next to Mississippi. So it's kind of a corner there. And this one town, he only ran Malden Saturday nights. He had a building. And I think their TV was basically, you know, that was the early days of when you could take a camera out and use videotape, right? Late 70s, early 80s. And they probably, you know, like a lot of independents do now, they had one camera sitting on a tripod and then they shot it and they took the tape over to the local station that back then probably, you know, it was certainly wasn't a network affiliate, I'm pretty sure. If it was, it was, you know, number 204 out of 204 TV markets in the country. It was not on Memphis TV, I don't think, or it wouldn't have lasted long. Although, you know, there was a couple of times where the Poffos were able to get on, I think, Channel 24 in Memphis, which was their first independent station back then. That's, you know, when they went from three stations to four. But you could get a TV show on those days late at night, maybe for a little bit of money on a week station that had just started, but you didn't get much viewership.
Were you getting and did you watch Poffo's ICW? And if so, what did you think when you'd see these Randy Savage promos about challenging Tojo and Dundee and Lawler and Jarrett and everyone else to a fight?
Oh, we loved it. Me and Boland both, we loved it. And actually, I lost a few of those tapes because I gave them to, back in the days before I had two VCRs and couldn't make copies, I gave them to Christine Jarrett because she wanted to take them back because they, you know, in case they had a lawsuit, they wanted the evidence. But when it was on channel 62 in Lexington, I couldn't see it. But if I went to Boland's house up in LaGrange, Kentucky, and we took his battery operated black and white 12 inch TV that he had gotten from Western Auto, when he went in there, he was the 10,000th. He went in to return something for his mother and he ended up being the 10,000th customer and won a battery operated television. First time he'd ever walked in there in his life, fucking Boland. Right. But we would take it up on his roof. And boy, sometimes it was cold. That's where the cops tried to get us one time because we were so covered up in these jackets and warm-up suits and hats and everything because it was so cold trying to watch wrestling. The cops thought we were trying to break in the building from the roof. And, you know, anyway. And, you know, we came down because they're like, come down on the thing. Come down from there. So we went down. What's the matter? Oh, it's you guys. You know, what are you doing up there? What do you think we're doing on the roof? We're watching wrestling on TV. But, we couldn't get channel 62 unless we did that. But when they bopped down to channel 36, the signal strength increased and I got a better antenna and I was able to get it. And yeah, we watched and that's the first time I saw Randy Savage against Bob Orton Jr. Randy Savage against Leapin' Lanny Poffo. They had really high quality matches and good work in that studio. Their booking was just horrible because I think all of them were on fucking drugs at the time and it shit didn't make any sense and it just looked so outlaw. And they spent so much time talking about Jarrett's guys and challenging Jarrett's guys. You know, they would take out these big ads that they couldn't afford in the Lexington paper. Randy Savage challenges 3-on-1 handicap match. Jerry Lawler, Jerry Jarrett, and Tojo Yamamoto. Just, you know, bring a ham sandwich against $100,000. Well, even back then when people weren't smart that much, nobody believed that these ragtag band of ragamuffins had $100,000. So it was just automatically garbage. And that's the famous quote from Sputnik Monroe. Jerry Jarrett was sitting in the locker room one time in Memphis and they were all talking about these outlaws over there spending all their time challenging Jarrett's top talent instead of worrying about getting their own guys over. And Jerry said, I just don't understand how stupid people think. And Sputnik jumped up and said, well, hell, Jerry, I'll tell you how stupid people think. And then realized what he'd done to himself. Right. And then sat back down.
You know, one of the biggest what ifs to me in wrestling is if Randy Savage hadn't gone to Memphis in 83 because Bill Watts had been airing videos of him to bring him into Mid-South. So that entire 84 run, of course, Dundee ended up being the booker, so that may have put the kibosh on that to begin with.
Oh,
but
yeah.
the idea that, you know, if that Memphis deal hadn't gone through, that potentially instead of the Lawler-Savage feud, which finally, you know, paid off this thing that had been built up for years, that Savage would have gone to Mid-South. Just imagining him working for Watts is one of the biggest what-ifs for me. That along with, you know, the British Bulldogs going in 85, which is the other big rumor throughout the years.
Yeah, but if Savage hadn't gone to Memphis and had gone to Mid-South, you probably wouldn't have heard about Randy Savage after that. Because he was probably at that time not a person that – I don't know if he would have flourished in Watts' environment. But also – you got to remember at that point, they had spent 5 years as outlaws. Savage, from the time he took the name Randy Savage, from the time that he was Randy Poffo, when he and Lanny were partners, they had never drawn a dime. He had never been in a main event position in any kind of major territory, drawn any kind of money. And probably would have put him up there in Mid-South, but I don't know if his personality wise, if he and Watts would have got along very well. Yeah. But since he did, because what happened was when Angelo Poffo, the father, knew that they couldn't stay in business much longer and it was all coming to a close, he called Jerry Jarrett. He was trying to get a place for his boys to go. He knew he was pretty much done in the business, but he was trying to get a place for his sons to work. And, you know, he was putting out feelers and he called Jarrett and he said, you know, can we make up and make something out of this? You know, everybody's been wanting it. And Jarrett said, yeah, you know, because it'll be business and it'll be money. And when Savage got a chance to work with Lawler and they drew 8,000 people in Lexington and he worked on top in the Mid-South Coliseum and, you know, he worked with Lawler and had those matches. And plus, obviously, was managed by Jimmy Hart, who then when Hart went to New York, made the statement when they're asking, well, what's the talent like? Well, the best wrestler in the world is down there. You know, Randy Savage, you ought to bring him up. Boom. Savage went from. In 1983, he was shoplifting steaks at the Kroger on New Circle Road in Lexington to eat in an apartment with no fucking furniture in it. And in 1985, he was WWF champion and made $800,000 in 1 year.
Wait. Are you telling me that the story about him shoving a steak down his pants is true?
Of course it is. What the fuck? They were. He didn't. I've had girls tell me they were over there. He had barbells and a mattress on the floor in his apartment. That's what he had.
Wow. Now, I think this was from one of your tapes, and I don't think Brian had seen it until I showed it to him recently. I don't think we talked about it on the air. There is a Savage and Orton promo from ICW.
Yeah.
where Savage implies that they satisfy each other's manly needs. What do you remember about this?
I don't know if I ever saw that one. I saw the promos where they stooged off Tojo Yamamoto's real name and you know, said a bunch of inside shit like that. But I never recall that. And I would have to think that they were on some supplements of different kind, because I don't think that ever happened. But they probably were in entertaining themselves with it and didn't know that it would be being talked about 30 years later or 35 years later.
Yeah, and I have in front of me, I saved a scan that I had found online of one of their charity challenge promo ads to the Memphis guys. So there's a $30,000 triple charity challenge. I think it's Savage challenging Lawler, Valiant, Jarrett, and Dundee. If they win, Lawler, Valiant, Jarrett, and Dundee will receive a total of $15,000, plus an additional $15,000 will be given to United Cerebral Palsy. It's against Garvin, Orton, and Roop. Also, Ronnie Garvin, Bob Orton, and Bob Roop promise to shave their heads in the ring and never wrestle again for the rest of their lives. If Lawler, Valiant, and Dundee lose, ICW will pay $4,000 consolation prize to the United Cerebral Palsy Fund for their transportation expenses to and from Rupp Arena, plus any hospitalization and or psychiatric expenses related to the May 20th humiliation. If Lawler, Valiant, and Jarrett do not show up, they will receive nothing, and United Cerebral Palsy will receive nothing.
Nothing. The kids will get nothing.
Some people care more about their own health than the health of those afflicted with cerebral palsy. Remember, superheroes, you have nothing to lose but a bucket of yellow paint, a chicken, a diaper, and a baby bottle.
Every once in a while, it was a ham sandwich, too.
As Adolph Rupp said many times, the glory is not in the winning, but in the trying.
There you have it. And that's why they didn't draw any money, because if they just spent that much money advertising the matches they did have, they might.
Well, it does have the lineup. It does have the lineup, which it has. We've got a grudge tag team match. Rip Rogers and Bob Orton Jr. against George Weingroff, Brian's favorite wrestler, and Ronnie Garvin. Special tag team match, Superstar Barrio. It's Barrio here, which I believe was actually his real name.
Superstar Barrio. It was Bob Orton's brother, Barry.
Right,
Orton.
Yeah, Barry Orton. No, but yeah. I believe Barry is his real name, right? It's not Barry.
Well, now you're saying that like that anybody can tell the difference when you're saying
it's spelled
it.
Spelled B-E-R-R-Y, yes.
Yes, yes.
And the so Barrio and the Pride of Alabama, Doug Vines against Bob Roop and Terry Gibbs. If Roop and Gibbs win, Terry Gibbs will get 5 minutes alone with manager Izzy Slapowitz. Mixed tag team match, The Miser, who of course was Angela Poffo, and Aunt and Lady Satan, who was
and a true life gimmick.
Again,
you know that's the rib. Angelo Poffo was the tightest man in wrestling. He actually, to the point where he didn't like to wash his clothes often, because whenever the clothes are washed, it breaks down the fibers and makes them wear out more often.
So yeah, the Miser and Lady Satan, who's Cora Combs, against Rick McCord.
Actually, it's Debbie Combs.
Well, no, because it's against Rick McCord,
right. Okay,
and the beautiful Miss Debbie Combs. Gee, I wonder who was dating the promoter's son at this time.
Yeah.
Pistol Pez Whatley against the Mighty Yankee. The Black Avenger against Jeff Sword. Plus, the wedding of Mr. Stephen Cooper to Miss ICW 1980 Dawn Griner. That's a hell of a card.
it was a superstar, and that was at Rupp Arena, right?
Yep.
Because also, that's another thing, they had to rent them Rupp Arena or they would have sued, because Jarrett was in there the first Thursday of every month, but they didn't have to give him a deal on the rent, so they didn't run Rupp Arena very often because it wasn't fucking happening.
Mm-hmm. And so there was a video.
But one time they did have a riot, I think, when they ran Lexington. Most of the time it was at Henry Clay High School, I believe, and they had a riot there because they did a deal. George Weingroff... Also, his younger brother was Eric Weingroff, and Eric later on became a referee down in Mid-South, and he was a nice kid, but I can't remember who the heels were, but they were beating the shit out of George, and all of a sudden they go out and they grab this kid who was like 13, 14 years old, and it was Eric, and they threw him in the ring and started beating him up too, apparently thinking that everybody knew that it was the babyface's brother, but most of the people there thought that they had just gone out and got some fucking kid out of the audience and thrown him in the ring. And a bunch of people hit the ring trying to save him, and there was a big fucking riot. And it was goddamn bad fucking business over there.
So we sent you a video.
Uh-oh.
I wish the one you already watched.
Hold on. Which video are you going to talk about?
Iron Cheek.
Okay. See, we got two videos. But
yes.
Yeah.
This just came. I happened to tweet it the other day, and then I asked Brian if he had ever seen it. I was surprised he had not. And then we sent it to Jim before the show. So I guess it's circa 84, 85. Iron Cheek gets arrested and charged with misdemeanor assault somewhere in Connecticut. And his lawyer is a man named Mickey Sherman. I pulled up the excerpt from his book online. Should I read that before we talk about the video?
How long is it?
It looks like it's less than a page.
Or maybe
a little more than a page.
Go for it. Just go for it.
Sometimes the only way to maintain one's sanity in this system is to take advantage of opportunities to get the job done and have some fun at the same time. Well, that's my theory, at least. Years ago, the most recent World Wrestling Federation champion was arrested on a minor charge in my area. Having recently lost the championship belt to Hulk Hogan, the Iron Sheik was driving down the Connecticut Turnpike. He stopped to get some gas. Politely asking the attendant to fill up his tank, the Iron Sheik, who looks every bit a sheik, regardless of his attire, okay, was met with some incredible hostility by the young man at the pump. "I don't pump gas for commie Iranian motherfuckers." Scream the young
now,
man.
Now, hey, nobody ever proved he was a commie.
Well, he teamed with a commie, though. And he would say Iran and Russia were number one.
Well, true. Okay.
So, yes, "I don't pump gas for commie Iranian motherfuckers." Screamed this young man, obviously exercising his patriotism against the Sheik. The Sheik pumped the gas himself and tossed the money to the young man, who claimed that the Sheik pushed him out of the way. The state police were called and picked up the Sheik a few miles down the road, arresting him for a very minor misdemeanor. They were incredibly apologetic to the Sheik and clearly wrote in their report that he was a complete gentleman. Although they believed he was the actual victim, they still had to make the arrest because the young man had made the accusation. This is not uncommon with a, quote, one-on-one complaint situation. The police will make the arrest and let the court straighten it out. After being...
You ain't kidding. I've been through a number of those before.
Yeah, I was thinking that as I read it. After being hired to defend him, I learned the Iron Sheik was indeed a true gentleman. An Iranian Olympic gold medalist, Olympic, well, yeah, no, yeah, Olympic
the gold.
Excuse me, it said wrestling medalist. Neither, none of that's true. He had been a bodyguard for the Shah of Iran and was a hardworking, decent family man. The conventional manner of defending him would have been to show the prosecutor and judge what a good guy he was by bringing in his sordid letters to the court attesting to his good character. Surely the case would have been thrown out, or he would have been ordered to complete some type of first-time offender program, which would have resulted in no conviction and no other harsh results. So why not do something different then? We have all seen the interviews the wrestlers do on TV. They come on one by one to discuss their upcoming match. They start out calm and deliberate and soon build or degenerate into wild posturing and screaming into the camera about how they're going to pummel their opponent and what a creep he is. For some reason, it occurred to me that this is the way I should present the Sheik's case as well. The judge who would hear the case was known for being very severe, but I also knew he had the best sense of humor on the bench. I would appreciate the effort. I ran it by the people for whom Sheik worked, and they had no problem with it, trusting my judgment. So he shows up, told them the judge's name, do their thing. This was all the coaching they needed. They were brilliant. They spit, swore, and screamed to the camera, demanding justice for the Sheik, but in a respectful manner. The Sheik stood by my side in full garb. He had been to a music video with Cyndi Lauper, who was kind enough to show up as well to help out. He stared into the camera, and she stared into the camera, made an impassioned plea that came straight from the heart, brought to the court. The judge loved it. The prosecutor.
By the way, I'm hearing you read this now, and I just think of James Earl Jones reading with all this passion and emotion of a pay. But no, go ahead.
The prosecutor loved it too. The only one who was pissed off was the young quote victim. Case went away. Everyone was happy. I made about 20 copies of the video for the judge, who I was later told showed it to everyone who came within 2 miles of his home. I have shown it to countless lawyers around the country at various seminars when I have lectured on innovative trial techniques. The reaction is generally 70% love it, 20% are pissed off that I made a joke of it, and the remaining 10% think I should be committed to an institution. I continue to work on my numbers here. So, yeah, so the video was posted online when he put his book out. We watched it. Jim, what do you think?
Well, I tell you, when I watched it, I didn't realize that it probably wasn't serious and that he thought Sheik was going to get off anyway, because I would have thought that this lawyer would have been disbarred if this thing had ever seen the light of day, and it probably, especially by the time Gene Okerlund got finished, that Sheik would have gotten 30 years to life. It was pretty fucking bad. It was bad in a good way, or good in a bad way. What do you say? What's the right way to say that, Brian?
It's both.
It's both.
Yeah. It pretty, you know, and hopefully it's like, I know there's some questionable attorneys out there in the world, but this guy, he couldn't have talked Nixon out of Watergate. He couldn't even got sodomy reduced to tailgating.
What other, do you have any memories of other crazy things that promoters did or that lawyers recommended doing to help get wrestlers off from various crimes?
Well, you know, in back in the old days, once again, the promoters usually, especially in an Eddie Graham or a Bill Watts or a Vern Gagne, somebody, Vince McMahon Sr., in their territory, they were so connected politically and well thought of in the communities that you know, pretty much you could get your guys off for any. And I mean, my God, Fritz Von Erich in Dallas, yeah, he was able to cover up arrests at the airport of his boys. You know, things that you would, that today would be instant worldwide news you never even heard of. And I can think of for one instance, just in my own, the first time I got arrested in Louisiana, we're coming back from the ring in Baton Rouge at the Centroplex, and they had bicycle railings, but this guy charged toward the railing and kind of stepped up on the bottom of it, put one hand on the top and leaned over and took a swing at me. Right. And I ducked it and drew back where I made my mistake was when I drew back and hit one of the cops in the head. But I drew back and I whacked him with the racket. And then here came Bill Dundee, who was the booker but not wrestling at the time, so nobody knew who he was. And he was on the other side of the rail and he drilled that guy. I hope it was one of his working punches, because if it was, the guy could never have recovered. Just drilled him and got him down in the front row of the bleacher seats and peppered him a few times. And there was a big skirmish, and the cops grabbed and everything. So we get in the back, and everybody had seen the fact that he swung at me, but the one cop was mad because I hit him in the head on my backswing. So he, you know, basically ticketed me or whatever the fuck they do, whatever they call it. He didn't take me in at that point, but he wrote me out a ticket. And Grizzly Smith, of course, who was Watts's road agent, said, well, you're going to have to go to you're going to have to go up there and, you know, or down there or wherever the fuck and be booked and fingerprinted and everything. And then we'll take care of it. And I said, well, I said, I ain't going to jail unless you go with me, because I'm going to be in Little Rock the night before. And that's the closest we get to Louisville. And I'll just see you later. No, no, no. Don't do that. I'll be there. So I, on my only day off, I have to go down to Baton Rouge, go to the police station. Grizzly meets me. They take me in. They fingerprint me. They do the mugshot and everything. They put me in a cell, and of course they put me in a cell. It was supposed to be by myself because they knew who I was and they weren't going to put me in with other prisoners. But there was one other guy in there. And the whole 30 minutes I was in this cell, his feet were sticking out from under a blanket. He was stretched out on the cot on the other side, and the blanket was up over his head. He never moved. It might have been a body. I could swear I saw him breathing, but I could be mistaken. The motherfucker never moved, right? And then they come get me and say, okay, Grizzly had gone and talked to him, and whatever. I said, well, what do I got to do now? He said, nothing. You're done. Okay. So then we got sued. We got served with a lawsuit paper. The guy has sued the Midnight Express, Mid-South Wrestling. I still have the – as a matter of fact, some of this was reprinted in the Midnight Express scrapbook that you can't get anymore because it's out of print. But he sued the Midnight Express. He sued Mid-South Wrestling. He sued an unnamed assailant who was Bill Dundee, who just didn't go back to Baton Rouge for a few shows after that. He also sued the Baton Rouge Centerplex, which was a city-owned building, and the city of Baton Rouge. So we got these papers, and we said, Grizz, what do we do? He said, walk across to this building over from the Centroplex and talk to this attorney. So we went over and talked to him. He said, I see. I'll let you know if anything happens. Okay. We never heard another word because the guy was trying to sue the city. It's Louisiana. It's the crookedest state in the country. You can't sue the fucking city down there. So we never heard another word. We never hired a lawyer. We never answered any papers. We never did anything. It was in the newspaper that he was suing the city. I have the newspaper article on the wall in my office. The headline is Wrestling Spectator Claims He Was Fed to the Lions. So nothing ever. That's 1984, right? Nothing. Because he tried to sue the city. 1990, we go back to Baton Rouge, the first time we've been back since our run in Louisiana for WCW. We were down there in Louisiana for a week. We get served again. The guys filed a suit again, and he named the city again. What did we do with it? We crumpled it up and threw it away and never heard another word. If when you watch Cops and they have the Mardi Gras episodes, that's the way that the cops treat everybody down there. They can do whatever the fuck they want to you in Louisiana. That's why every bridge is named for a goddamn governor, because the governor's brother-in-law sold him the land, even if the bridge doesn't go anywhere. Talk about a bridge to nowhere. Sarah Palin don't know what she's talking about. We used to have to go to Houma, Louisiana, and work in a building in a mud field every 2 weeks on Sunday afternoon in front of 400 people in a ring with real ropes. And it was like a stage because they had bands in it also. And the guy ran an auction where he auctioned off everything from cakes to fucking firearms, because as long as that show ran, whether it made a dime or not, you could get into Baton Rouge in the building. Otherwise, you couldn't. Every politician in the state of Louisiana that's ever been has been a crook. Every cop has ever been in the state of Louisiana is a crook. They can do whatever the fuck they want. You don't say nothing to them except yes, sir, and go on your fucking way. So when these assholes on Cops act up at Mardi Gras, that's at the downtown municipal auditorium. The room right next to the back door was where the cops would bring anybody that jumped in the ring. And if the heel wanted a time to speak to him alone, the cops would drag the fucking perpetrator back to the back. They'd throw him in that room. They'd wait for the DiBiase or the Hacksaw Duggan or the whoever to come back. They'd point to the door. The wrestler would go in the door, close the door. You'd hear a little conversation. The wrestler would come out, and then they'd go and get the unconscious body, and they'd throw him out in the fucking parking lot. And nobody ever got in trouble because you couldn't fuck with the cops. Because did I mention they're all fucking crooked because it's Louisiana? That's the fucking legacy of Huey Kingfish Long.
Oh, boy. Well, listen, before we go too much further, it is time for something that we do every week here on the show, and that is the Dennis of the Week. It is something that actually started when you were on our show, and you and I talked about our mutual friend, the late, great Dennis Caraluzzo, one of the great guys I've ever met in my life. And what we've done since that last episode, you recommended that we do a Dennis of the Week. And we've done that. We've had different guests on. We have other guests planned for future shows telling stories about Dennis. And now that you're on again, and it's a weekly segment, it's your turn. You have to come up now with the Dennis of the Week and tell us a Dennis Caraluzzo story.
Well, and I think, and this is something actually that I'm not sure that you're even familiar with, but Kenny Starmaker Bolin made the acquaintance of Dennis Caraluzzo, the wrestling czar. You would have to figure that in the world of professional wrestling, that two personalities as outsized as that would have to get together, right? Well, they did. Because it was maybe the late 80s or the early 90s. Maybe no, it was right around the mid 90s or whatever when Dennis started going down to the Memphis territory.
Like 92-ish.
Yeah, there you go. Because Lawler made a lot of shots on Dennis's cards up in Jersey. And Dennis, a couple of times they had fan trips from Philly down to the Memphis territory when they were still running full time. And they would go to the matches and everything. And at one of those, Dennis and Star Maker made their acquaintance to each other. And it seemed that Dennis, for some reason, every time he got around Kenny, he was very unlucky in that he would always lose a credit card. And for some reason, every time Kenny got around Dennis, he was always lucky in that he would somehow always find it. And I believe some of this, as I believe, may be detailed in Starmaker Bolin's book, I Probably Screwed You Too, The Mostly True Stories of Kenny Starmaker Bolin, which you can find Kenny Starmaker Bolin on Twitter, at Starmaker Bolin, and also on Facebook. He doesn't have a website because I think you have to exist on paper with the government to have a website. But anyway, and what would happen is that back in those days, before, you know, this instantaneous computer, you know, business got going, you had a little time on these lost credit cards. and somehow Kenny would know that not only was this card lost, but it wasn't going to be reported for 24 hours. And as a result, Bolin ended up with tons of audio and video equipment, and the Coraluzzo children ended up with nice clothes and toys, and just everybody just had a good old time. And then these cards were reported stolen, and of course they were canceled. But by then, somebody had fraudulently made purchases, and that went on pretty much almost until Dennis's death, because I think finally at one point some people came to see Dennis and were looking for a few items that they actually found in Dennis's house. And after that, but you'll have to have Star Maker on sometime to give you more information on that. But after that, he didn't lose as many. He was more careful with his possessions after that. He didn't lose as many things after that.
Oh, that is! But, I hadn't heard that, so that is wonderful.
It's well, you got to figure that if in a business, in the same business where there's two personalities like Dennis Caraluzzo and Kenny Starmaker Bolin, they had to get together sooner. That's why when I booked which one was it? Was it the 98?
It was 98. It was the third one in 1998.
Yes. Kenny drove up and he managed like Ace Darling and Devin Storm, and he managed a couple of teams, and he was out to cut about five or six interviews in front of those people in Philly that didn't know what had hit him. And he talked about how he was a big star on Big 58 TV in Louisville and WDRB Fox 41 in Louisville. And by the time that he left that place, those people wanted to lynch him. And that was back when you could probably still have gotten a rope around Kenny's neck, and several people could have fucking thrown it over a limb and hoisted him up before he gained too much weight.
That was the only time I ever met Kenny, and we had a tape party the night before the show up in my hotel room. I used to bring a VCR, hook it up to the TV before they started hooking up the TV so you couldn't do that.
Yes.
And I would bring up various tapes, and I remember you came with Kenny. It was the first time I met Kenny, and my lasting memory of that is Kenny had with him a newspaper, and he showed it to me. He goes, "You see that?" And there was an African-American man on the cover. He goes, I said, "Yeah." He goes, "That's our friend from high school. He just murdered someone."
Well, no, you have the story wrong.
Okay.
I hate to do that. I know it's your show, but you have the story wrong. Correct. He had just got murdered.
Oh, that's what it was.
By the cops. Adrian Reynolds was this young black kid that was like a year or two younger than me and Kenny, and he used to hang around us in LaGrange because he went to school with Kenny, but he was, you know, a couple years younger before whatever the fuck. And this was, 10 years or better after that time. And he was arrested on some, you know, bullshit charge, and he was thrown in the Jefferson County Jail, and he came out dead. And his picture was on the front page of the newspaper, and there actually was a picture of the governor of Kentucky holding that newspaper up saying, "We're going to investigate this horse shit." And that's the paper that Kenny had, because Adrian Reynolds went into jail alive and came out dead. Which just goes to show that this is not a modern phenomenon of cops, you know, killing black people. And it's not even a modern phenomenon of it's getting publicity. It's just that nobody continues to do anything about it.
Yeah. Well, now I want to hit on a few topics.
And as a matter of fact, Adrian Reynolds also was the eyewitness to another crime. Because Adrian was over to Kenny's apartment one night when he lived on Main Street in LaGrange up over the dry cleaners. And in the middle of the night, me and Kenny used to go out on Main Street in LaGrange because, after all, after 11 o'clock, there wasn't a human being to be found. And we would fly Frisbee down the center of Main Street until a train came by because there was tracks down Main Street. And one night, we happened to get into an impromptu wrestling match because we had seen very exciting matches that day on Memphis TV. And I nail Kenny with a right hand, and to sell it, he flies backwards and he flew right through the glass door that led up the stairs to his second floor apartment and just broke it into a million pieces. And he jumped out, and we looked right and we looked left, and we said, "There's no witnesses," and we got the fuck out of there. And we went down to the Kroger parking lot and flew some Frisbee for a while. We come back a couple hours later, prepared to exclaim shock and amazement if Kenny's mother had got home or if anybody else knew that this door was broken. But Adrian Reynolds had been asleep upstairs in Kenny's apartment the whole time. And he was still there. And we go in, and he wakes up and hears us come in. And we said, "Adrian, who broke the door down there?" And he said, King. That's what he called Kenny at the time, King. He said, "King," he said, "I saw him. It was a bunch of guys. They come and broke your door out and said, 'Fuck you,' and then ran off. I chased them off with a ball bat." Adrian was always ready to help.
Well, as I was saying, I want to hit on a bunch of topics real quick before we watch the video that we had sent you. So I'm just going to touch on a few things. The Jimmy Valiant song, "Son of a Gypsy." I know what the lyrics are. Is he saying, in your eyes, that he is a little funky Jew?
No, he's a little funky too.
If you listen to the song, does it really sound like he's saying, "I'm a little funky too," or "I'm a
little"? Well, if you listen to any of Handsome Jimmy's interviews, it didn't sound sometimes like he was saying almost anything English. but no, he was because I know this because I also, as a matter of fact, even rarer than the single 45 RPM record of "Son of a Gypsy" is the one that that Jimmy Hart sang, because Jimmy Hart wrote the song and he laid down the track. Well, there's people calling me already. He laid down the track and recorded it, and I actually have sold a couple of those that I just happen to have around and still have a couple of copies left. But it is clearly he's a little funky too.
Okay, now I'm going to touch on something that may be a little bit of a sensitive topic, and please forgive me, but it's something that's come up on our show, so we need an answer. The last time you were on, we talked about wrestlers wore wigs. We said Bruno Sammartino, Killer Kowalski, Freddie Miller as a personality. You brought up Arn Anderson when he first started. Since then, we've also talked about Ed Whalen, who eventually wore a wig.
Yes.
Jim, did Stan Lane wear a wig?
You know he did, brother. But here's the thing. In Smoky Mountain Wrestling, of course, Stan and I had walked out of WCW, and I spent a year gearing things up for Smoky Mountain Wrestling, and the Midnight Express were supposed to be my top heel team, but we never dreamed they would re-sign Bobby Eaton, but they did. Because, you know, once again, all of the Jim Herd didn't want to, but all of the producers and all the agents and all of the creative team, everybody said, you got to sign Bob Eaton. So they did. So I got Tom Pritchard to take his place and made him the Heavenly Bodies. And we had shot a few introductory videos, and finally they were supposed to make their big debut. And Stan comes in the TV taping. We were at a high school gym. And as he opened the door, I see him walking in. The light, the sunlight is behind him, so all I can see is a silhouette. And it looked like he was wearing, it appeared to be a coonskin cap. And as I got closer, I said, what the fuck have you got? He had gone to New Jersey, and I love you, Stan. I don't mean, you know, but he had gone to New Jersey to this hair clinic and had gotten a hairpiece sewn to his scalp, installed, if you will, on top of his head. And I said, what the fuck? Because he was getting a little thin on top. But now, you know, today, this is 20 years later, more than 20 years later. Today, he looks great. He's got as much hair as I do. But anyway, I said, Stan, can you work with that thing on? He said, well, we'll find out. And come to find out, he was so sensitive about it. We had to do the old Mongolian stomper thing. And he wore a headgear. The amateur wrestling headgear, and we did the stomper thing where he's got an inner ear problem. Don't make noise. And the people would scream and yell, and he'd hold his ears, but really the headgear was to hold his fucking hairpiece on, which looked like a possum. So finally, after a couple of months, Tom and I go to meet Stan at his hotel, and we pick him up. We're going to a show in West Virginia, and he comes out with a baseball cap on, and he had that look on his face. And he sits down in the car in the passenger seat, and he looked at us, and he whipped the hat off. You know what grass looks like when you've laid a piece of carpet on it for a while, and you take it. His existing hair had not been bleached because it had been under that thing, and it was all matted down to his head, and he looked 50. And I said, Stan, what the fuck? He had come in the night before, because even with that headgear, a few of the stitches had come loose, and it was that deal where he would wrinkle his forehead up and his head would move, but the hair wouldn't, or vice versa, or whatever the fuck. And he took his cuticle scissors and the mirror of a Super 8 motel and just cut the fucking thing off.
Wow.
So that was $3,000. And, you know, but then he washed it and he got it colored again and he looked fine. And today he's 10 years older than me and he looks 20 years younger than everybody. And it never hurt his production with the ladies. So, you know, it was just one of those things that, you know, bad mistake, bad decision, bad choice.
All right. A few more lightning round questions.
Lightning round. Is there a prize at the end of this?
Yes. If you go to, if you go to your local store and say Bick sent you, you get a free hot dog or a soda.
If I went anywhere and said Bick sent me, they'd probably put me in jail.
Well, we'll tell you about Bick's in jail in a few minutes. A clip not seen in the Jim Cornette rookie year DVD set is you on Memphis TV in 1981 with Lance Russell, and you present to Jackie Fargo, upon his retirement, the Wrestler of the Decade Award. My question is it for the decade of 1971 to 1981, or is it for the 80s, or is it for the 70s? What decade exactly
did Jackie Fargo... It was for the decade that Jerry Jarrett told me that it was for, because the reason why they wanted to get Jackie Fargo on TV for a particular reason, so that they could do an angle with the Dream Machine and a bunch of other people, and some Dream was switching back heel, and there was going to be a massive brawl, and the MacGuffin, the reason, if you will, why that Jackie Fargo was on TV that day was to be presented the Wrestler of the Decade Award by Championship Wrestling Magazine, of which I was the boy editor. And I was on live TV in front of 300,000 people in the Memphis area for the first time I've ever been on television since I was in the audience of the local T-Bar V Ranch show when I was 5 years old here in Louisville with Cactus Tom Brooks and Randy Atcher, the singing cowboy. I'm on TV. I'm scared to death. I've got to introduce Jackie Fargo, one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, and then I've got to get out of the way, because they didn't tell me what they were going to do, but the Dream Machine, because he knew I was smart. We were friends. He kind of gave me the Iggy and said, you need to get the fuck out of the way as soon as something happens. And And so that's the only reason that I knew kind of what was going on. And boom, you know, it was what it was. Nobody would have ever dreamed that I would be a great promo from that appearance. Let me just say that. I think I introduced him by saying, "Here he is, Mr. Fabulous Jackie Fargo." I was shaking like a dog shitting peach seeds.
You should have gotten Lance to cut the promo for you.
Well, he was trying to. If you could see, he was holding the microphone for me, and you could tell he was trying to send it by mental telepathy.
When did you finally feel comfortable doing promos?
After the first 4 to 6 weeks, I started feeling more comfortable. When I first was doing the promos, they really just worked around me. I had to do was react and say just a few things, and everybody else did the work. But that was before I was a heel, because when it started out, obviously I was trying to sign up all the good guys and be the antithesis of Jimmy Hart. And because I was a clueless rich kid putz, they blew me off, and that made me mad. And that gave me a reason to get even, and a reason to be a prick, and a reason to want to be a heel and talk bad about them. Then I could get into it. Cause I don't know, you know, if you've ever been in the position, it's easy to do a heel promo, but it's fucking hard to do a babyface promo. You can get people to dislike you a whole lot easier than you get them to like you.
Yeah. Two more lightning round questions. You know, one thing Ric Flair talks about whenever it comes up on his podcast, he seems to really have a hatred for Bill Dundee. He puts him down as a booker, which, you know, is funny considering 1984 Mid-South and some of the work he did in
the record year they ever had. Yeah.
Yeah. The best year of Mid-South ever had, and all the work he did in Memphis at various times. Do you know why Ric Flair has such a hatred for Bill Dundee?
I actually do not, and I don't know, you know, maybe it's something that came up in the 90s when they were both in WCW together, because I don't ever remember when I was with Rick in WCW and Crockett, him ever knocking Bill or speaking bad about Bill. So, no, I don't really know where it would have come from, unless it was, like I said, something that had it in the mid-90s, and a lot of people got mad at each other in the mid-90s in WCW, and it's lasted till this day. I mean, Ole and Rick used to like each other until they didn't. So I don't know, but I gotta be perfectly honest with you. As far as bookers, I would rate Bill Dundee so near the upper echelon, as not only with booking, but especially with finishes. He's one of the better finish guys that I've ever come across in this profession. And as a matter of fact, I've written many of his down and saved them and stolen them and used them again. And they always work.
And then the last lightning round question is, we talked last week on our show, we did our tribute to the Mongolian Stomper, and we talked, amongst other things, about his 1975 work with Jerry Lawler. You know, that leads me to wonder, and I think I know the answer, but I think our listeners would be interested. What's the story with Jerry Lawler's 74 banishment from Memphis?
Actually, in my book, Tuesday Night at the Gardens, Pro Wrestling in Louisville, it gives the story from at least Jerry Jarrett's side. And to be honest, I don't know that I've heard Jerry Lawler disagree with this. Jerry had been when Lawler and Jim White were a tag team and Sam Bass was made their manager in Memphis for their first big run where they started setting records. As a matter of fact, it was probably late 1972 that Lawler and White were first put together as partners. And they broke in and spent some time in Alabama, Mississippi, down there. But then also they were sent over to the eastern part of the state of Tennessee, over to the Knoxville territory. And they spent some time there kind of, you know, getting their shit together. And then they were called back over to Memphis and they were put on top. Well, at that time, unless you were Ron Wright or Whitey Caldwell, you weren't really figured in to make a lot of money in East Tennessee. And so then when all of a sudden Lawler and White become the top team and they set all those attendance records, and then Lawler gets the singles push and he has the match with Briscoe for the world title in Memphis. He's only 22 years old. He's one of the top 10 box office attractions in the country. He, at the end of the year 1974, he went to Jerry Jarrett. He said, "Hey, have you got me booked in Johnson City, Tennessee next week?" And Jarrett said, "Well, I haven't got it done yet, but why?" He said, "Well, don't book me because I ain't going." Because it was 500 miles from Memphis, and you didn't make a lot of money over there. Well, that wasn't allowed back in those days because you couldn't have this guy, even if he was making a whole lot of money and drawing a whole lot of money, you couldn't have the guys telling the booker or the promoter where they were going to go and where they weren't going to go. And Jarrett apparently decided he would nip it in the bud right then. So Lawler's push evaporated. He did a lot of jobs. He was switched babyface for a brief run, did a lot of jobs on the way out, and then was sent down to work underneath in Georgia and Florida for 6 to 9 months. And he came back and was put right back on top in Memphis and had a whole lot better attitude about the towns he was going to make or not make. And you know, that's the story that I've always heard and that Jerry has told and that I tend to believe because everything fits. You know, having said that, that's the difference in those days and today. When Jerry Jarrett was on my podcast here not long ago, I asked him what would have happened if he'd have been in charge of the Click instead of Vince McMahon. If you had four top guys that you were paying a fortune to in payoffs, whether they'd drawn money or not, and they were drawing money, but they not only would tell you that they would put so-and-so over and they wouldn't put so-and-so over, they'd make such-and-such date or they wouldn't make such-and-such date, and they would go out in your biggest arena in front of a sellout crowd and hug each other and expose the business because they wanted everybody to know that they were in the same little clique, what would you do? And he answered, it would be just like, Jim, the day after they shot President Kennedy. We would get up and we would be sorry that they were gone, but life would continue. Well, and that's the way that every promoter used to think, and that's why that the business ran very efficiently with a few hiccups for 100 years, and then all of a sudden guys started thinking they were bigger than the business and promoters started letting them get away with it, and it went to hell in a handbasket real quick.
Okay, well, now we need to talk to you about a link that we had sent you, because this worked so well last time we figured let's try this again.
All righty.
Bix and I on a previous episode had talked about wrestling audition tapes. I have a few from Dennis's collection, and Bo James, our friend, a friend of Bix and I, a friend of yours, our resident East Tennessee expert here on 605, sent me some YouTube clips that he had put up of different people auditioning for Southern States Wrestling. One of them is a match that I'm not going to say anything about before we watch it, other than to say a few things. This is the match.
You're not going to say anything, but you'll say a few things.
I'm going to try not to give away too much. Here's what I want to say. According to Bo, one of the guys in the match has been working for 20 years. Another thing you should note is that it's the audition tape for a wrestler named Rock and Roll Roy Toy. I have no idea which one of the wrestlers is Rock and Roll Roy Toy, because it's not at all, you know, he's not named in the video. It's just he sent this video in, and here's Rock and Roll Roy Toy. It is a three-way match, and Bo very much wanted me to stress on the air that he never has hired any of these workers. This wasn't for him. This is not one of his shows. He put the tape on YouTube as an audition tape, but he has no involvement with any of the wrestlers that you're about to see. And with very that, good. I sent you a link.
I do have I have the link up now. I have my finger on the clicker. Should I click on this?
You should click. The video should be set up to 1 minute and 6 seconds in, which skips a lot of the minutiae beforehand.
It certainly is. It is.
Tell me when you press play.
And I've just pressed it. It looks like they're in a, I don't know what they're in. They're in somebody's living room with curtains across the back, and there are five people sitting in one front row. The bell has just rung, and there's two guys with a lockup, but another big fat fuck just broke it up. And now a guy just ran off into the ropes of his own volition and fell down in front of another guy. And now the guy that he fell down in front of is picking him up and shooting him off left-handed. Wait a minute, a guy in a white T-shirt just walked in front of the camera and screwed the whole thing up. Oh, but now they're continuing to fight. We have a tracking error. And now the big white shirted fat fuck just fell down. It appears he might have had a heart attack because nobody hit him. The referee is shaking his head and wondering why he can't get back to Jiffy Lube quick enough. Now the one guy tried a clothesline, but the guy that clotheslined the other guy fell down himself because the other guy just ran through his clothesline and knocked him down. The guy in the white T-shirt is now locked up with another of the guys in a T-shirt, and there's a shoot off. A clothesline. The guy actually took a bump that got clotheslined. That's we're improving here. They're on the job training, learning as they go. I'm still not sure which one is Rock and Roll Roy Toy.
No, there's a guy in white, guy in black, guy in red.
Yes.
Which is helpful.
There's the, drop kick to the stomach. but the guy that got drop kicked just beat the guy that drop kicked him up to his feet. And now they lock up again.
The guy in the white shirt has bounced up from everything so far. He hasn't sold.
Well, it's because he's so fat. He has to bounce up.
Are we sure this isn't Lucha Underground?
Wait a minute. I think, yes, this is an audition tape for Lucha Underground. They were going to clothesline the guy in the white t-shirt, but he fell down first. And now the referee's telling the other guy, while they're not looking at you, maybe you can slip out unnoticed. This has had 474 views on... Oh, because Bo James says, I've been promoting wrestling for 20-plus years and have gotten hundreds of videos from people wanting to get booked. I have kept the really good ones and really bad ones, and I'm wondering which one that he thinks this is. And one of the comments says, Dear Lord, all I can think of is there's a perfectly good ring amidst all this crap. It does look like a nice ring. They have red, white, and blue turnbuckle pads. Either there's now a hold, or the guy in the white t-shirt is crying and the other guy's comforting him.
Jim, which one of these guys do you think is the one who's been working for 20 years?
Apparently the referee, because he's the only one who looks embarrassed. Oh my God, it was almost a sidewalk slam, but the guy couldn't pick the big fat guy in the white up, so he just drug himself down. The referee's trying to quick count him, but nobody will stay covered. Oh, the guy in the red just shot the guy in the black off into the ropes, where he jumped over the guy in the white and then was drop kicked and fell on the guy in the white. I think that's a hernia.
And there's now also a dwarf in front of the camera. I don't know if you've noticed.
Lean against the pool table. Yes.
Another left-handed shoot off that clothesline. The guy actually landed on his head.
Oh.
Now, who was the other video that I watched? Was that P-Bay Diaz?
P-Bay Diaz.
Yes, he just became Ricky Steamboat. Because this is, yeah. I would hesitate to say, now the three people just got up out of the front row and walked out. That means there's four left.
And now someone just shoved the dwarf in front of the camera. Or no, that wasn't the dwarf. He shoved someone. Now people look getting into a fight in front of the camera.
As a matter of fact, I think there's a riot in the audience. The referee just quick counted one of them to get it out of there. That obviously was not the finish, and now a bunch of people just jumped in. Okay.
So Bo had sent us this, and along with this link, he had sent us a link for a few other auditions he received, and one of them, Bix and I were both stunned to find out, we probably shouldn't have been, is someone you had also received an audition tape from, a wrestler known only as Godbold.
Godbold. I remember Godbold. Yes, I do. I have a feeling that he sent out a lot of those videos.
Well, the one you described sounded even better than the ones Bo posted.
Well, I don't know what Bo's looked like, but I can pretty much tell you that the one that I got was, I believe it was him just sitting there playing a guitar. I'm not sure.
You said something about the guitar glowing, or...
Yeah, there was some kind of fiber optic business going on, and the guy was sitting there next to his pet dog. And I saved some of the tapes just because you could tell that it looked like it was put together like a ransom note, where there was just writing at odd angles all over the whole tape, and the labels were all over the place.
It came from Mike Leno.
Oh, you beat me to it.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah, poor Leno. You know, I really enjoyed him before he got too much on the nitrous. But some people would send – and, of course, but then now I got an audition tape from these two other clowns named Storm and Jericho, and that worked out for the best. But it was either feast or famine in the 90s, definitely, with these audition tapes.
Now, was Godbold during the Smoky Mountain era? I would think it was, given it's another East Tennessee promotion.
Actually, I think I got that. I'm going to have to go through my cabinet because I have some really award-winning stuff in my cabinet. I'm going to have to go through that. But I think it was during the WWF days because I got a lot of tapes in Smoky Mountain. But I got a ton of tapes in the WWF because no matter who they were addressed to in the office, they ended up in a box in my office. And And I was allegedly supposed to look at those and see if there was anything of note that and you can be sure I went through a bunch of them.
You know, you're mentioning Jericho and Storm reminds me. Have you ever seen that tape that Jericho talks about in his book that he got sent by fans where they're farting and worshiping Ricky
Morton? The crab boy?
Yes.
Are you kidding?
The one from Barberville. Yeah,
from Barberville, Kentucky. No, not only did we see those tapes, but I knew those people in person. They were our regular fans that came. One kid did the upside down Bray Wyatt thing where he walked like a crab, and they had in their living room, they had a picture of Jesus on the wall next to the picture of the Rock and Roll Express. The picture of Ricky Robert was bigger. They were some of our most devoted Smoky Mountain Wrestling fans. Yes, everything that Jericho said in his book is completely true. And plus, besides that, there was other stuff.
Because he talked about it being like this tape trader legend, and like everyone that I've talked to and that was around then, I think Brian, same for you, had never seen it. Like I've talked,
well,
like,
no, it. Well, it wasn't a tape trader legend because it was only in Smoky Mountain because Brian Hildebrand was the repository for tapes like that in Smoky Mountain. But we all, because Jericho used to stay at Hilda Muffin's, you know, apartment, and yeah, we all watched those. But I think Brian Hildebrand ended up with all of them. But yes, those folks were at the matches every month in Barberville.
There used to be a fan in Barberville who, the two times I went there in 94 and 95, would show up dressed like a member of the Rock and Roll Express. You know, he had the bandanas all around his ankles and he had the whole outfit. It always was the funniest thing to see this guy walking around as, you know, he had like the attitude, like he was one of the wrestlers.
Wait, are you sure it wasn't Godbolt?
I'm positive. I'm positive it wasn't Godbolt.
Barberville, that was where this one huge corn-fed farm girl snatched a hold of Tammy Sunny one night and had her by the hair and was dragging her across that gym floor by the hair. And she was, not only was she bigger than all the security guards, but all the security guards were guys. So nobody wanted to hammer this woman. And Brian Lee grabs Tammy's feet, trying to stop her from, he couldn't hit the woman, but he was trying to grab Tammy's feet. So they almost pulled her in two. It was a tug of war. And I think Brian would have lost a tug of war anyway with this fucking woman. They were into their wrestling in Barberville, and we loved them for it. It was one of our better towns.
Did the woman try strangling Tammy too? Because as we learned a couple of weeks ago, apparently she likes that.
I feel like Lance now. Lawler, what do you got to come in here and say that for?
Hey, Jim, it's Lance, hey. Partner.
You know, speaking of Barberville, you know, as we talked about earlier, you know, weird things happening with wrestlers and lawsuits and stuff. Wasn't there an instance where you got into an altercation at Barberville and it ended up with the judge sentencing you to something that ended up boosting the houses? You had to apologize in the ring or something?
Actually, this may be a good one to go on because I don't think you can top this. Me and the Heavenly Bodies coming back from the ring one night after a particularly hot finish, and as the cops are muscling us through the people on the way to the entrance of the locker room, somebody kicked me right in the leg, and I'm sensitive about my knees because they're bad, right? So I spun around with my back to the locker room door. I said, "Who did that?" And some guy jumped out and said, "I did." Well, whether he did or not, he's admitting to it, right? I'm like, "Okay, motherfucker." I start to go to him. He starts to go to me. Tom and Jimmy are trying to hold me back. I ran and popped the buttons off of my shirt to get away from them. Me and the guy lock up. I've got my hand on his hair. He's got my jacket collar, and I'm whacking him over the head with the right hand with the racket, and he's punching me with the other hand. And it's like the hockey fight thing until they pull us apart. Nobody really got dusted up too bad. I get back in the locker room, and at that point, the cops are still trying to keep all these people back and hold them, calm them down, whatever. So I take my knee brace off real quick, and I'm sitting in front of Ron Harris, you know, one of the Bruise Brothers. And I put my foot up on the bench, and I took the racket, and I whacked myself in the shin as hard as I could. And his eyes got big as pie plates. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I got to have a mark." Well, of course, a big egg came up on my shin real quick. And right then, the cops come in. I said, "What happened out there?" I said, "Look, he kicked me right in the shin." The guy sees the egg. Oh, shit, right? So the next month, they come up there. And of course, the guy's sworn out a warrant, assault, blah, blah, blah. Can't remember what the guy's name was. So our local promoter, Dennis Chestnut of Chestnut Tax Service, if he's still around, if you're in Barberville, he can get you out of anything. So anyway, I said, "Dennis, you deal with this." He said, "All right." So he calls me at home Tennessee a couple weeks later, said, well, you got to come up, appear in court on such and such. He told me the deal. I said, okay. So I went up there, and they took me in the back, right, where I guess the judge's chambers. I wasn't sitting out with the, you know, the regular folks that were being arraigned or whatever. And so then they call my case, and I go in the side door and come into the courtroom, and the people are like, oh, shit, it's Cornette. He's on TV. And I pled guilty to something or other. I can't remember what it was. I would tell a lie if I said what it was. But anyway, the judge said, fine, in that case, I sentence you to $100 court cost, and you must apologize to the wronged individual that you assaulted next Saturday night at Knox Central High School at the Smoky Mountain Wrestling Matches. So that our house was up. People came to, you know, hear me apologize to the guy, and I apologized to him in the ring by saying, I'm sorry I had to hit you because you're such a stupid fuck, or whatever the fuck I said. I backhanded apology, and yeah, we shot a little angle in the courtroom. It was fun. These kind of things are the reason why they looked at me sideways, I guess, when I tried to go to Canada. But fuck Canada anyway. Actually, not fuck Canada. I like Canada. I like Vancouver. I like Toronto. Wasn't warm on Montreal because the signs give me a headache. They're not in English as they should be. And Winnipeg sucked. But I like the Canadian people, but the Canadian border guards can go fuck themselves with a rusty fishing knife. I will never try to go to that country again.
By the way, for those who don't know, it's not that they started turning you away at the border. It's that they started turning away the border decades after all of these things happened.
Yeah, no, this was like 5 years ago. I was there 25 times without a problem, and then suddenly, without even knowing who I was, they just decided they were going to fuck with us and detained us and fucked with us and ran our shit and everything, despite the fact that nobody was looking for me and I'd done no harm to anyone. So the way they treated us, fuck, I don't need their fucking country. I was going to spend money there. I'll spend money in my fucking country.
Apparently that's not an uncommon experience, too, that people just have out charges and just...
Yeah, no, I've had I don't know how many wrestlers tell me it's easier to get into Saudi Arabia than it is to get into Canada. They're a bunch of fucking pricks at that border, and they can go fuck themselves. They said, well, you're going to have to leave, and you don't come back until you get this piece of paper or whatever. I said, you don't have to worry about that. That's the easiest promise I'll ever make, because I wouldn't try to come back to this fucking place if I had a goddamn engraved invitation from your fucking prime minister or your president or whatever the fuck you've got up there. But it's a shame because I like I said, there's a great buffet place in Toronto. If you're in the Toronto, Mississauga area, it's called Wasabi. Oh, it's fucking fantastic.
Well, on that note, as we begin to wind up the show, when you were previously on the show, you rightfully so gave Bix some grief because he couldn't do his plugs in a coherent manner
or
timely manner. So we're going to do a 60-second Bix challenge. Bix, because he has like 50 things to plug. It's like a parade of plugs every time we do the show. Bix, you have 60 seconds to get every single one of these things in or a buzzer will go off.
And I do have a timepiece with a second hand right here. I'm going to keep an eye on it also.
I have it in my hand.
And I'll do it on my phone to keep you honest.
Bix, tell me when you're ready and I'll hit start.
Okay. On your mark. Finish it.
On your mark. Get set. Go.
All right. Well, this week, of course, we got a new episode of Between the Sheets with me and Chris Ulner talking about this week in 1991, which includes not an in-depth description because you should go read it, but the issue of The Observer that turned out to be a week in the life of Dave Meltzer because the WWF was making his life hell, among other things. Good show. No guests this week due to a late cancellation, but check that out. Otherwise, nothing too notable this week. I've got something out later this week that I have to kayfabe for the moment because I don't think I'm supposed to say that it's coming out yet, but that'll be fun. Follow me on Twitter at David Bix. As for everything else, just briefly, Fighting Spirit Magazine, Figure Four Weekly at WrestlingObserver.com for subscribers, plus all the stuff I do at SE Scoops and MMAnews.com, and we are at 50 seconds.
God damn it, I was really hoping to buzz you. I'm going to do it anyway.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I got to be perfectly honest with you. Like I told Linda Miles one time after she had a match in OVW.
I wasn't committed enough to it, no.
No, I said basically that's the worst fucking wrestling match I've ever seen, but at least you hit your time.
All right. Well, as I said earlier in the show, you can get with Jim at jimcornette.com. Cornette collectibles, all sorts of great books, DVDs, old programs, pictures, canceled checks, anything you could want. from professional wrestling at jimcornette.com. You could listen to Jim every week, whenever you want. Doesn't have to be the day it comes out. Jim Cornette Experience on mlwradio.com as well as iTunes. For our show, the 605 Super Podcast, I want to plug two things. One is because Bix and I are actually going to attempt to make a dollar and a cent off this show somehow. I have kids to feed, and Bix has all those illegitimate kids running around Long Island. You could use our Amazon referral link. It is tinyurl.com/605Amazon. And, of course, when I say 605, it is 605, for those of you who get confused easily. And to use that link, Amazon.com's a referral link, again, tinyurl.com/605Amazon. It's the same price you would pay for anything else on Amazon. It's just that by using our referral code, Bix and I get a little bit of a cutback. So please consider it. We've told you about lots of different things, lots of different books and other items on this show. You could also, if you need to get spoons or light bulbs or a mop, just use our referral link and we get a little bit of a cut. Also, to join our ever-growing community, you can go to facebook.com/superpodcast, and that is the official 605 Super Podcast page on Facebook.
Now, I have a question for you, by the way.
I hope to fuck that people listen to this show with a notepad and a piece of and a pen, because elsewise, I don't think there's any way they're going to remember all this shit.
Well, we got the links in the description stuff, so that's all good. But now, Brian, I have a question for you, because I forgot at first, because you were the one who set it up, not me. At first, I was looking and I forgot, and I tried going to facebook.com/605pod, which was already taken. That's why you took Super Podcast. What was that? It was in Japanese or something? What?
Yeah, I don't know. I saw that and I just said, what the fuck? I think we'll just use Super Podcast. We'll just use that for the branding on the Facebook page, and it works fine. So that's what that is. And Bix, you want to do the Twitter plugs?
I already did
There's
mine.
There's more?
You
There's
do yours.
More?
I already plugged my Twitter. You
the
do yours.
Plugs, the plugs are longer than the show.
You can follow Jim Cornette on Twitter at TheJimCornette. You can follow me on Twitter, I have learned, at GreatBrianLast. And I think that's it. So until next time, for David Bix, for my anger management therapist, Jim Cornette, I'm the Great Brian Last saying, tally-ho!
And, of course, Lou Albano, what else can you say?
Judge, the only thing I can say is I know Cosgrove or Vasheek for some 15 years. He has set a fine example. As rough and as tough as he is, he has gone with the youth. He showed people how to wrestle. He's a silver medalist in the Olympics. He's got it all together. In my book and in your book and the book of the people, this is a man that is a family man, has three children, has integrity, has decency, has honor. Yes, he's rough. Yes, he's tough. Yes, he's wild at times, but misunderstood. He does not speak the language. He does not understand the language. He can be misinterpreted. He can mispermeated, misdebilated, missubulated. But the man is one of a kind, often imitated, but never judged. Just a minute. I don't care about your election. I don't care what you're running for, because you ain't bothering me. But I'm going to tell you, with all honesty and decency and integrity, this man is one of a kind. I respect him as a human being. He wrestles rough. He wrestles tough. He's unbelievable. Never matched. But he's a good, compassionate human being, a family man. Listen to me. Give him a break. He's good. He's honest. He's decent.
But
God bless you. Thank you. But what?
But do you feel strongly about it?
Do I feel strong? Yes, very strongly, because I know he's misunderstood, misinterpreted, and he's a good man. If he weren't good, I wouldn't stand up for him.
Thank you very much.
And I'm the captain. You got it?
Thank you, Lou.